Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. We are on the America Out Loud Network. Thanks so much for joining me today. Blue Lives Radio is part of the Blue Lives Matter Network. And as such, we not only bring things of interest to the law enforcement community, those men and women who are currently serving or have served as a law enforcement officer, but also we have a huge contingent of people who support the American law enforcement officer. And I want to welcome you to this week's episode. We've got a great show for you. We got a fantastic interview with the former police commissioner of New York City, Bernie Kerik. And I'm going to give you my view from the blue as we walk into the briefing room.
The briefing room, headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
In this week's episode of View from the Blue, I want to talk to you about respect. The respect of public officials and the police. Or maybe I should say, the lack of respect between public officials and the police. There were a couple of incidents that happened this week, and I want to bring them to your attention, and I want to talk about them. One of them, which really incensed me, was an incident that occurred in Stuart, Florida this week. Now, Stuart, Florida is a relatively small community. They have 40 law enforcement officers, and it's a kind of a bedroom community, I guess is the best way to talk about it. And they have a mayor there, and her name is Eula Clark. Well, Eula Clark walked into a convenience store, and in that convenience store, she saw a uniformed police officer who worked for her community, and in full view of he and also all of the other people that were in that store, she made this comment: "I didn't know we were serving pig tonight." Yeah, you heard me right. She said, "I didn't know we were serving pig tonight." Now, the law enforcement officer, the police officer who worked for the town, kept his dignity, didn't lose his temper, which I got to tell you, I don't think that I would have been so inclined to keep my temper in check. I don't think I have that much control. I think I would have said something, but he didn't. Instead, he left and he went in and did what he should have done. He reported it to his supervisor. Well, it became known and went on to Facebook, of course, and I heard about it, and Blue Lives Matter heard about it, and I wrote a post that went absolutely insane and was picked up by quite literally tens of thousands of people who supported the police officer and were so angry at this mayor that it really caused quite a considerable backlash. I contacted the city and gave my viewpoints on my belief that she should be removed from office. It's a little more difficult to do than it is to say, of course. But they were absolutely inundated with emails like mine. I went onto the town's website and made comment about it, and I could see that there were just hundreds of incensed people that believed that she shouldn't serve any longer. Well, in the last few days, besides all the literally the thousands of comments that have gone up, the pressure has been intense. I saw the city council meeting where each one of the commissioners on the city council asked her to resign. Now, she did, to her credit, give an apology, but the apology was about as tepid as it gets. What she said was something along the lines of, in fact, here it is. I'm telling you, I'm sorry. And I don't know. That seems pretty weak to me. She said she just wanted to move on. She did it. She was sorry, and she wanted to move on. Well, I'm sure she wants to move on because she got called out on it. And, you know, when a public official says something like that, it carries a lot of weight. First of all, it carries a lot of weight to the police department itself, but it also carries a lot of weight to the community. If that is what your leader of your community thinks and says, well, that says a lot about her character, if you ask me. And I wonder if she thought about the comment before she said it, or if this was like an utterance of what the mind was thinking, and she just blurted it out, which is just as scary, if you ask me, because that's what's in her heart and in her mind. And this is not a dumb woman, by the way. She is a practicing attorney. So we're not talking about some moron that just spouts out whatever they think. But perhaps that's what happened. In any event, she's facing the heat. I hope that she is forced to resign or is removed from office, because as far as I'm concerned, the disrespect that she showed that police officer is exactly the kind of thing that we as a nation should not condone. So that's one thing that happened this week, but that isn't the only thing that torqued me. I was contacted by a police officer in the Bellevue, Washington area, and he told me that there was something about to happen in the Bellevue school district, and that his wife was an employee of that school district. And he wanted to bring to my attention that on the 31st of January, the teachers of that school were banding together and going to wear Black Lives Matter t-shirts to support that organization. Now, the Black Lives Matter movement is, in every sense of the word, a racist, hate-filled organization. All you have to do is watch them march where they scream, "What do we want? Dead cops. When do we want them now?" And call for violence against not only law enforcement, but against America. And here this group of teachers is going to go into the classroom where they hold sway over children. The children who look at their teachers with respect and absorb everything that they say. And what are they going to see? They're going to see their teachers representing the authority figures in that school supporting a racist hate organization. Now, what I really found interesting when the police officer told me that his wife had brought this to his attention was the fact that she didn't want to wear a t-shirt. And many of the other school personnel didn't want to wear t-shirts. But what happened? They're being pressured into wearing those t-shirts. You know, peer pressure is a pretty powerful thing. And basically, this organization, this teacher's organization, is pressuring all of the people to conform to the beliefs of some. And it's very difficult to say no in those circumstances, to have that courage, and then face scorn and disdain and other pressure from your coworkers. It's a really tough situation to be in. So here's what the t-shirt said, by the way. On the front, it said Black Lives Matter in the same type of lettering that all their t-shirts have. And on the back, it said, "I stand for and with all of my students who are targeted due to their race, gender, orientation, immigration status, religion, and or ability." Good God, could they figure anybody else to throw in to become a victim here? I find it pathetic. And so I contacted, I know that shocks you, I sent an email, a letter that I wrote. It was a fairly impassioned letter, I must admit. And I called him out on it. I called him out on supporting a racist, hate-based organization. And many of the people that that follow me on Facebook and also Blue Lives Matter, they also sent emails to this school district. And what I got back was a very tepid reply. It was absolutely canned. It was the typical politically correct speak that you would expect. So what I did, I contacted the school board. By the way, the school board disavowed any part of this. What they said was, we don't interfere with what our teachers' union wants to do. And it's not even the teachers' union. It turns out to be a group of teachers. But of course, the school district could say, no, you can't do that. But they didn't. They went the total politically correct route and gave permission. And as such, when I invited someone from the school board or the teachers' group to appear on this program, I'll give you one guess as to what the reply was. It was crickets. They didn't even bother to reply. So they gave me a canned email in reference to the email that I sent, but they didn't have the courage to come on this show and talk about the real ideas behind what created this mess up in the Bellevue School District. So, in essence, we had a mayor in one city and an entire school group of teachers in another, all of whom are in positions of influence. The mayor, the influence of a city, and teachers, the influence of hundreds of children. Well, the future is going to be a little difficult for law enforcement if they keep on seeing that children are being programmed to hate them. And the same as in Florida, where a mayor leads by disrespecting the police. Thankfully, we have a lot of law enforcement supporters who rose to the occasion, voiced their opinions, and that is a voice that must be heard. And that, my friends, is this week's View from the Blue. Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is brought to you by Blue Lives Matter. BlueLivesMatter.blue is our website. That's news and information, everything from the perspective of the law enforcement officer for law enforcement officers and their supporters. Check us out at BlueLivesMatter.blue. And also, Warrior 12 Clothing.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. It's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. We invite you back to AmericaOutLoud.com to get all the latest. Make it a daily stop and also get the app. You go right to the App Store and download our free app, and that will put all our content right into your hands on your phones and your tablets. It doesn't get any easier than that.
Welcome to the interview room at Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. With me today is a very special guest and a longtime friend, Bernie Kerik, who was the police commissioner in the city of New York from 2000-2002 and the commissioner for the Department of Corrections for 6 years prior to that. He was a lifetime employee of the NYPD, basically, and also a military veteran. And we've got a lot to talk about. Bernie, thanks so much for being on Blue Lives Radio.
Thanks, Randy.
Well, the first thing I want to bring up is what I believe to be a serious injustice that has taken place involving the pardon and commutation of sentences for literally thousands of people that our former President Barack Obama did as he left office. I mean, he pardoned and commuted the sentences of murderers, of drug dealers, of people with violent pasts, and you know, the reality is this, that there are people that deserve a second chance, and there are people that have, you know, made mistakes. And, you know, Bernie, you're a person that that asked for a pardon for a situation that you were involved in, and the President Barack Obama ignored it. And instead of pardoning a man who served his city with distinction, who served his country with honor, he in fact chose to give that type of pardon and commutation to thousands of hardened criminals. And I personally want to say to you that I believe that was a tremendous injustice, and I'm sorry that it happened to you.
Well, listen, I don't know. The politics is a dirty business, and this is, I think, was strictly political. You know, for your audience that may not know me, in 2004 I was nominated by George Bush, President Bush, to take over the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And after that nomination, within a week or so, I had to withdraw my name from consideration and explain to the president that I hired a nanny, a domestic servant, my wife and I, hired a nanny to take care of our children, to which we paid cash, did not pay payroll tax. Well, that led to a torturous 5 years of state and federal investigations over the nanny and over some apartment renovations I had, and eventually I gave up the fight and ran out of money and pled guilty in 2009 and was sentenced to 48 months in federal prison. I did my time. I did what the government wanted. And last month, a couple months ago, back in November, before the election, actually, my attorney and I applied for a presidential pardon. And the premise being that, you know, I did what the government wanted me to do, in addition to my 30 years of service to this country, to the city of New York, to, you know, sort of much of which is unparalleled in this country. I ran two of the largest law enforcement organizations in the nation. I was the police commissioner during the 9/11 attacks, overseeing the response, the rescue, the recovery, and the investigation for the NYPD. After I left the NYPD, I was President Bush's appointment as the interim Minister of Interior of Iraq. I worked for the King of Jordan for 4.5 years. I've been sort of commended and decorated from presidents, kings, queens, you name it. And I thought, you know, that would account for something in the presidential pardon package. And I have to tell you, Randy, look, you know, if he decided not to do me, fine. But to give a terrorist, a convicted terrorist, who was responsible for, you know, 4 murders down in the West Village, not to mention his participation in the FALN, and, you know, they were involved in hundreds of bombings and in attacks on society back in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s. You give a guy like that a pardon or commutation, you know, this kid Manning.
Well, let me break in for just a second, because I want to give my listeners just a little bit of background. There was a tremendous article today. Brian Darling wrote it for The Hill, and where he brings this up, and I just want to read a couple of the paragraphs from Brian Darling's article. And out of 209 commutations, 41 of these people had firearms convictions. 2 death row murder convictions were commuted. There was Mitchell Ray Campbell of Twin Falls, who was pardoned on 2 separate convictions, the first a cocaine distribution, and then a false tax return. Then a second conviction for distribution of cocaine and a felon in possession of a firearm. Over 1/5 of the commutations involved some element of violence. And then, as you're referring to, the Puerto Rican terrorist Oscar Lopez Rivera. He helped establish the FLAN, which was best known for bombing the Francis Tavern in Lower Manhattan in 75. They killed four people. He was tied to at least 100 bombings, most in New York. And the 1982 New Year's Eve bombing of NYPD headquarters, which left three NYPD officers seriously injured, blinded, or maimed. I mean, it's absolutely, absolutely outrageous that he would choose those people to pardon and to commute sentences of, and ignore a man like you whose life of service is beyond question.
Yeah, it's listen, like I said, the only thing I could say is, and I think Brian Darling summed it up pretty well in the article. You know, he said, you know, that the president, Barack Obama's pardons were based around his progressive ideology and his politics. And then, look, I'm a former cop. We know what he thought of cops. You know, I wasn't a protective, protected society in his eyes. You know, a member of society, and you know, it is what it is. You know, it's depressing, but you know, just move on. I try not to look back and think about it.
I can understand that, but it's not like you're letting grass grow under your feet, are you?
No, listen, you can't. You know, I've had some, Randy. I've had a crazy career, a crazy life. You know, I've had the highest of highs, you know, from a high school dropout. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Lean on Me with Joe Clark and Morgan Freeman, you know, back in the 80s. That's the high school I went to in Paterson, New Jersey. I dropped out at 16 years old, and I wound up in the Oval Office being nominated for one of the highest cabinet posts in the land. So I haven't done too bad, you know, and my life continues. So I just take it one step at a time. Right now, I'm pretty pleased with what's going on in the country with regard to the president and the new administration. I'm not pleased with the lunatics out there that are protesting and cop bashing and you know, all this nonsense. But listen, I think it's a new day for the country, and I think the president's made it clear he wants to make the country great again, and I think that's what he's trying to do, and I wish everybody would get out of his way and let him do his job.
I believe there's a new day for law enforcement, having contact with literally hundreds of police officers every month, from the furthest reaches of small-town policing to the largest cities. I've seen that there is a hope. You know, Barack Obama, when he first was elected, promised hope and change, which the hope went to hell, and the change was all for the worse, as far as I'm concerned. But what we're seeing now with Donald Trump as the president, law enforcement is seeing hope, and they're seeing change already. I mean, the fact of the matter is that Mr. Trump has already shown his deep and abiding respect for the American law enforcement officer, and his empathy and sympathy for the lives of the officers who have given their lives in the line of duty and solace to the families, which is deeply
Randy, respected. Let me talk about that for a second, because I have known the president now for close to 20 years. I knew him when I was correction commissioner. We worked together on a few things when I was police commissioner. Ironically, there is a photo that sits in my office that was taken of him and I on September 9th of 2001.
Oh, wow.
My family had a birthday party for me. He came to this surprise birthday party. There was a photo taken. And who would have ever thought two days later we would be attacked in New York City? But looking at that photo today, you know, I sit back and think, wow, you know, who would have thought 15, 16 years ago this guy would be the president one day? And for the cops that are listening, for the men and women in law enforcement, you should know that I don't know of any other president that's ever going to be or will be, you know, has been as supportive of the law enforcement community as this guy. And I know him personally. So he loves the law enforcement community. Keep in mind, the guy that today, right now, that runs the Oval Office, the director of Oval Office Operations and the special assistant, special deputy assistant to the president, is actually a former New York City detective.
Really?
And yeah, yes. His name is Keith Schiller. He used to work for me. He runs Oval Office Operations for the president. He is also the guy when a cop is killed these days, unfortunately it happens, the president has been calling the families of the law enforcement families of these guys that have been shot and killed or died in the line of duty. Keith is the one that actually puts it all together and gets it to the president, and the president calls the family and extends his sympathies and his support. That kind of stuff has never been done before, and he takes it to heart. He's a genuinely good guy that believes in right and wrong and good and evil, and he understands what the men and women in law enforcement do. So I think it is definitely a new day for the policing arena in this country.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, I remember George Bush. One of the things that he did that no one ever, he basically kept it a secret, was during Law Enforcement Week at Washington, D.C., he would actually take an entire day and meet with the families of the officers who had been killed in the line of duty that year.
Yep, that's right.
And I remember, because I was there representing the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department's Honor Guard during those years, and I saw the look on the faces of the survivors and how they reacted to the President of the United States actually caring about their loss. And I think that's what we're seeing with President Trump as well.
Yeah, I believe it. Absolutely. 100%.
You know, one of the things that has been in the news a lot, and I'd like to get your viewpoints about it, is the violence that has been infecting the inner cities, especially in places like Chicago, where the murder rate has just been, astronomical. And the federal government came in, and just in the waning days of Obama's reign, and, once again found that, blamed the police for all the problems in Chicago, just as, as they have done with other places. And, New York was so successful in diminishing the violent crime and the ability to live life in the city, basically much, much more safely. And what would your suggestion be to the police department or the government in Chicago? Do you think that if the same principles were applied to Chicago that were applied to New York City PD, that there could be a tremendous diminishment of violent crime?
You know what, Randy? You could the police department in Chicago could sort of run parallel programs that the NYPD did, but they would not reduce crime, and that's because they need new leadership. The reduction in crime in New York City. Keep in mind, this last year, Chicago had 762 murders. In 1990, New York City had 2,000, over 2,000 murders.
Wow.
And in the 8 years that Giuliani was in office, into my last two, as I went out the door, we had reduced violent crime in New York City by 65% and homicide close to 70. Okay, that's over an eight-year period. In the next 12 years, during the Bloomberg administration, that number dropped substantially to the point that this last year, I think there were 350 homicides in New York. There were more homicides in Chicago this last year in 2016 than there was in New York City and Los Angeles combined, put together. That is completely absurd, and a lot of it has nothing to do with the police department. It's the leadership of the city, and the mayor in Chicago has to come to the realization that the cops have to be allowed to do their job. He's got to give them the support they need to do the job, professionally, personally, and he's got to be there and support them and give them the benefit of the doubt when there's a problem. Now, you know, granted, there's bad apples in every bunch, but it's far and few between. But places like Chicago, places like Baltimore, places where we see this crazy crime rate and young men and women being slaughtered like a war zone, these towns are all run by Democratic mayors. It's got to stop. Get these people out of there. Get somebody that cares about the community. Get somebody that's going to put the resources into the community that needs to be had, and let the cops do their job. And I'm sure if that happened, nobody can tell me you can't reduce crime in Chicago. We did it. We did it when it was three times more in New York City. Don't tell me it can't be done. It can be done. I did it. I did it. I know it can be done. But you need the right leadership in command of the city, and you need the men and women to have a leader to follow. And right now, the Chicago Police Department doesn't have anybody to follow.
Exactly. And you know, the former police chief of Chicago, who was basically, you know, bounced for political purposes about 6 or 7 months ago, he came out recently after the Department of Justice announced their findings against the Chicago Police Department. He was never even interviewed. The federal government, Department of Justice, talked to the guy that was the head of the agency when they made their determination.
You know what, Randy? That's Gary McCarthy. Gary McCarthy used to work for me. Gary McCarthy was my deputy commissioner for operations in the NYPD. He left the NYPD, went to Newark. He left Newark and went to Chicago. And you're absolutely right. The federal government came in, conducted this so-called, you know, major inquiry and investigation. And they didn't interview the guy that ran the agency, which is pretty telling and leads you, you know, the obvious to believe, you know, this is clearly political. You know, how could you not interview the guy that runs the agency or that ran the agency, I think, for 5 years? Like, come on. That's ridiculous.
It's absolutely absurd. And, of course, under the Obama administration, there were, I believe, 27 investigations into police departments, including Ferguson and other places. And, of course, every single one of them resulted in a consent decree it resulted in some type of negative finding, which devastated the police agencies. They're not
right.
Concerned.
It seems to be, you know, they continually make it about the police. They had the highest crime wave in decades, but it's all the police. The police is responsible. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. And you know, the problem is, as long as government, as long as the cops aren't getting the support they need to do their job, and they're being continually bashed the way they've been in the press and by our political leaders, who's going to go out there and put their lives on the line in the ways they used to? Not many guys are going to do it. You know, I don't want some perp living in my house because he sued me and the government I work for didn't indemnify me because of some issue. You know what? I'll stay away. The cops are always going to respond to 911 calls. They're always going to respond when somebody's screaming for help. But are they going to go out there and actively and aggressively police the way they used to and really be responsible for reducing crime? You know what? When you constantly have a governor or a mayor saying, we're going to lock you up if you violate some rule or some law, even if it's perceived and not real, who wants to take that chance?
Exactly. And of course, when we're seeing the what's sometimes have been called the Ferguson effect. It's been called depolicing. And Chicago, the recent statistics have shown exactly that stops of pedestrians and vehicle stops have been diminished by almost 80%.
Now, that's right.
You and I both know that you can be an empty suit and you can survive a police career doing the bare minimum. But
right.
When we talk about good cops and people that we know, and we talk about the people that are going out there and doing the job every day by making the car stops for for no taillight, for any PC stop, in order to try and turn that into either a felony arrest or stopping a crime before it occurs. That's what proactive policing is all about.
Yeah, listen, policing in this country today is very different. And whether it's Chicago, you know, and I sort of live vicariously through my son today, who is a Newark cop. He's in Newark, New Jersey. He's been on the job for 11 years now, and he's on the Newark SWAT team. I can tell you that it's a very different agency than it was, you know, 10 years ago, 8 years ago. The NYPD, they still do a hell of a job, but they're working for a mayor that I'm absolutely convinced could care less about the individuals that work in the police department. So, you know, when you have that kind of leadership, you know, you're going to have cops that, you know, they're not going to go out there and put themselves at risk.
Yeah, it's only human nature is to bring in the horns in order to get through your career.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
You know, when Mayor de Blasio came out and put in the training budget millions of dollars to retrain the police officers in kinder, gentler policing, I knew that the handwriting was on the wall.
Yeah, well, listen, anybody that looked at that curriculum, this was a couple of years ago, you know, some of the stuff in there was, you know, take two steps back, don't chew gum. You know, it was like some of the stuff I read was bizarre. But at the end of the day, listen, there's always room for training. There's always room to make men and women better in the job. But don't diminish what they do. They need to have the support, and they need to feel like, you know, they're being backed by their bosses. And today, in a lot of these bigger cities, especially under Democratic rule, they don't have that support.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, and we have seen, you know, last year we saw a tremendous increase in the murders of police officers from the year before. And even more disturbing is the fact that many of these were ambush attacks and target attacks against law enforcement officers, of which NYPD lost several. And it's my belief that when we're talking about training law enforcement officers, the first and the foremost training that they should have is in surviving their careers physically, emotionally, ethically.
And yeah, you know what, Randy? That's been the case, or should have been the case for forever, right? From the beginning of policing. But today, you know what their first and foremost thought is? Surviving their jobs politically.
Yes.
That's what this country has turned into. It's no more personally and professionally and tactically and operationally. It's not about that. Today, it's politically, because they could be annihilated because some politician that sits in a place and has no idea what they do and would never have the courage to go out and do it, they sit there and make decisions based on what these cops do, and they don't have a clue whether it's right or wrong, good or bad, indifferent. They don't know. So that's the problem, and that's the world we live in now.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're absolutely right. Well, you know, besides all I could sit here and talk to you all day about policing, because it's something we are both very, very passionate about. And I look forward to the next time I'm on the East Coast that maybe we can have a cocktail and talk about things just like this. But I want to talk about you for a moment, if I can. You know, besides your police career, you've also written books. You're an author.
Yeah, I've had some bestsellers. My first autobiography came out in 2001. It was called The Lost Son. And most of that is my law enforcement career, and it basically ended right on September 14th, right after the attack on the towers and President Bush coming to Ground Zero on September 14th. That's where the book ended. And my most recent book came out in March of 15. It's called From Jailer to Jailed. That book is pretty much in time sequence starts, you know, on September 14th of 01, and takes you through my nomination as Secretary of Homeland Security, my run-in with the government and my time out. So it's I've had some you know, some interesting things. I think from a law enforcement perspective, it gives cops a very bird's eye view of a very active and aggressive career. When I was a cop, I was extremely aggressive, extremely decorated, a lot of good stuff in New York City. I think cops and men and women in law enforcement would like them.
And it had to be a very, almost a painful book to write, too, I would imagine.
Well, the second one was sort of really painful because you had to live in the aftermath of what had happened. You know, and I've tried to explain to people, especially, you know, bad guys, bad people that do bad things, you know, going to prison, having your freedom taken away from you, maybe it doesn't bother them. But I have to tell you, for somebody like me or you or somebody that has lived their life in a law-abiding community, when your freedom is taken, it is the most profound thing you can think of. And somebody asked me when I came home, they said, you know, what is it like? You know, what is prison? What is going to prison like? And if I had to sum it up in a sentence, it's like dying with your eyes open. Because basically you are put into a stagnated position where your entire life goes on without you in it. And the only thing you could do is watch. And I also learned, you know, a lot about the criminal justice system. Somebody like you or me or a lot of your people that's listening, you know, we think of prison as a place where there's a bunch of bad guys. Until I got into the federal prison system and I met commercial fishermen that caught too many fish, and they were put in prison. I met a kid that sold a whale's tooth on eBay. Somebody enhanced their income on a mortgage application to buy his first home for him and his new bride. Wound up in federal prison. And I have to tell you, I was numb as a result of seeing a lot of the stuff that I've seen. And when you think about the urban communities and the communities of color, you know, in the state systems, you know, you lock up a guy with a misdemeanor possession. You know, it's a misdemeanor possession. It's a first-time offense. It's a low-level drug offense. And you know what? Hopefully that kid can get back on track. But in the federal system, a first-time, low-level, nonviolent offense, they're putting these kids away for 10 to 15 years. I mean, you talk about crucifying society and creating an environment where you kill these kids for life because a conviction, a felony conviction, is a life sentence. I don't care if you don't ever do any jail time. Once you are convicted of that felony, it's there for life. It never goes away. So these are all the things from a cop's perspective I never even looked at. I never even thought about until I actually went away and got to see it firsthand. When I came out, and I had people, I have advocates and the ACLU and people yelling and screaming at me, you know, you were one of these guys. Why didn't you do something about it when you were on the outside? Well, you don't do anything about it when you're on the outside because you don't even think about it. You don't realize it. You don't look at the family destruction of what happens. And listen, bad people that do bad things, they belong in prison. We have to protect society. Some people longer than others, and some maybe for life. I get it. But you know what? When you walk into these minimum security camps in a federal system or even in a state system, and you see people sitting in prison for 3, 4, 7, 8 years, 10 years, for first-time low-level drug offenses or some, you know, white-collar thing, you know, where they made a mistake and some guys didn't even know what they did wrong, but you had prosecutors that prosecuted these cases because they wanted a notch on their belt or they wanted a promotion, you know, it's wrong. It's just wrong. And nobody was, anybody that knows my record, they know I was extremely, extremely aggressive as a cop. I'm no different today in law and order than I was then. But I witnessed things that would outrage anybody in this country. If you saw what I saw and you witnessed what I witnessed, you'd be outraged and there would be change because, you just it's not American.
And that gives a whole different perspective on empathy when you are subjected to seeing that and how that would radically change the way you view the law enforcement system that you served for so many years.
No, that's right. That's exactly right.
People can check you out at the CarrickGroup.com. That's the Kerrick, that's K-E-R-I-K, group.com. And what you're doing now is you're consulting a great deal involving risk management and related topics.
Right. So they could just go online and look at the website, and you know they can find me online just about any of these social media sites. They're all online.
If you like really cool police t-shirts, especially ones that say Blue Lives Matter on them, then I suggest you go to warrior12.com. Warrior12.com is Warrior 12 Apparel's website, and they do have the coolest t-shirts around. Blue Lives Matter t-shirts. Also, there's some other designs that are pretty badass, I must say. And I wear them all the time. In fact, I got a closet full now, and I don't wear much else. I think I'm a walking advertisement. Of course, I suppose I should be. So go to Warrior 12. Get yourself some cool t-shirts. You'll also find them on bluelivesmatter.blue. But if you go to directly to the website, you can see the entire selection. Warrior12.com. In this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we are adding a new segment onto the show. It's called Law and Disorder. And in this segment, I'm going to talk about all kinds of news stories that affect the American law enforcement officer. And this is geared not just for those who serve, but for those who support the American law enforcement officer. I received a letter. It is a letter that was sent to me by the wife of a law enforcement officer. And she sent it to me as basically she had sent this letter to Donald Trump. And she wanted to make me aware of it. And she did this from a place of pain, unfortunately. She and I had a discussion about post-traumatic stress disorder. I prefer to call it post-traumatic stress injury. Because when you think of the word disorder, you think of some type of emotional disease, and it is very curable. So when you hear the word disorder, it has so many negative connotations. It is in fact an injury, just like getting your arm broken. It's part of you gets broken, but can be fixed. But I want to read this letter because it has so much impact. Dear President Donald Trump, from an officer's wife. The dear I began this letter with is no formality. I'm so grateful for you, sir. You are dear to me, and I don't even know you personally. You speak the truth and say things as they are without sugarcoating them. I admire your refreshingly blunt and direct way of communicating, and I absolutely love that you care for our nation's law enforcement. Stories of your kindness to law enforcement officers permeate the heart of blue circles. That kind of PR can't be bought. It is earned, and you have earned it. I'm grateful for you. We now have a commander-in-chief who really cares about my little family of blue. So with that being said, I want to draw your attention to a desperate need in our law enforcement community, a need that has put many blue lives at stake and taken many others. Mental health services. The last 8 years have been particularly rough. A fellow law enforcement wife describes the last 8 years best. Quote, when we had a leader that imposed the irrational and false impression on our great nation that criminals are victims, loss of hope and fear was instilled in many law enforcement and their families, unquote. Many of us lost hope, and we are worn out, tired, and weary. We don't even feel safe in our own homes anymore, as many have been the recipients of harassment or worse because of the badge our spouses wear. Then add the pain of losing so many brothers and sisters in recent years, the horrendous falsehoods spewed about us from the media, and the hated from a portion of our society. Many of us are the end of our ropes mentally. Officers are tanking their lives at staggering numbers, and I'm sadly not surprised. The main problem is that PTSD is often not covered by workers' compensation, and a huge stigma is attached if you speak of it. It's a horrible paradox. We are told to reach out if we need help, and when we do, our agency's hands are often tied as workers' compensation insurance companies won't cover PTSD-related illness. My husband recently reached out for help, and it went horribly wrong. The insurance representative on the other end of the phone dismissed his pleas for help by saying they would contest the claim, and then added insult to injury by asking, "Aren't you trained to deal with this? And why aren't you on medication? You aren't working anyway." I know mental health is a taboo subject, and it is impossible to see the injuries, but I'm here to tell you the world I've seen them in my husband firsthand. They are real, frighteningly real. No, my husband isn't a threat to himself or others, but it is a frightening thing to see your rock in life, hopeless and hurting. The nightmares, the flashbacks, the survivor's guilt are all crippling. Many officers have had to watch their own die in recent years. Many more have been drugged through the court as a result of a societal witch hunt. We aren't trained to deal with such things, and you can't just train law enforcement to deal with such tragedies. Families are hurting. We desperately need help. The horrors my husband has seen and experienced, losing a brother before his eyes and seeing another fight for his life, combined with being blamed by a defense attorney and smeared by media, has taken so much from my family. It has affected every day since that horrible day. We won't stop fighting the mental demons, but we do need help, sir. We are not alone in this journey. I speak for many families that are down and out. Some officers have lost their job because the pain is too much to bear. Amazingly talented and charismatic officers are leaving because they can't get the help they need. I'm grateful for a caring agency who is encouraging my husband to seek help, even though the insurance company won't pay. But many others are in a place where their livelihood and their lives are at stake. Being an officer isn't just a job, it is a calling. And when these officers aren't able to do their calling, it kills them from the inside. I know that you are doing your part to help with the media and societal roles that have caused much of the damage. I also know that you support your families, and that is an amazing feeling after we have endured under President Obama's leadership. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts. I would just like to add one more request that is equally important and often forgotten. Will you please help us deal with damage that has been left in the wake of the last 8 years? Please advocate for mental health services to treat PTSD in the law enforcement world. It will save lives, save jobs, save families, and help heal officers that have much compassion and care to offer our great nation. Thank you for your time, sir. After I spoke with that woman and I felt her pain, I knew that I had to read that letter to you. It is such a powerful letter, and it is so on point. In 34 years as a police officer, I have seen, in fact, I have suffered from PTSI, is what I'm calling it now. You can only see so much before you stop feeling, or you start feeling terrible things. And I couldn't agree more with her that something needs to be done. There are many agencies that, just as she talks about, just pushes their officers away. They basically abandon them. And that's wrong on every level. That's one thing that we as law enforcement officers and supporters have to work for. And that's one thing that Blue Lives Matter is going to work for.
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, we honor those who have lost their lives in the line of duty. Today, I have one name to read, Deputy Chief James G. Malloy of the New York City Police Department. Deputy Chief James Malloy died of brain cancer that he contracted as a result of inhaling toxic materials as he participated in the rescue and recovery events at the World Trade Center following the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. On September 11, 2001, Deputy Chief Malloy was driving to work when authorities stopped traffic through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel as the towers burned. When the towers collapsed, massive waves of toxic dust and debris flooded into the tunnel. Chief Malloy, covered in dust, went to Ground Zero and began working to rescue victims. He was assigned to the Ground Zero site for several months, where he worked in supervising the recovery and cleanup efforts. He served with the New York City Police Department for 35 years in many assignments, including as the commander of the Elite Emergency Service Unit and Detective Bureau, Queens. He is survived by his wife and daughters. He was a graduate of the 193rd session of the FBI National Academy. His end of watch was January 30th, 2017.